That might send the Yankees to the World Series. Boom, a hero in Game 7.
Clemens has set a major league record for strikeouts in a game.
Derek Jeter with one of the most unbelievable plays you will ever see by a shortstop.
Red Sox fans have longed to hear it. The Boston Red Sox are world champions.
Welcome to Fanbase, a deep dive into the greatest rivalry in sports. John Senecal, Brian Shackman with a special guest today. And it's special on multiple levels. Rico Brogna, Connecticut native. We are based in Connecticut for this podcast. Played Major League Baseball, grew up a huge Red Sox fan, got to play for the Red Sox, got to hit an important hit for the Red Sox in a season that they were hoping to unseat the Yankees. And so there are so many things to talk about. So first of all, welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is great. It is a great rivalry and fun to be a part of.
So, you know, I'll just quickly get out of the way. In the mid-90s, I dated Rico's sister, who is a lovely human being. And I will tell you that it was right after Rico got called up by the Mets. It was your first full season with the Mets.
95-ish.
Yeah. And so what we would do is at any time we could peel away, I worked at the Taft Summer School, we would go down. And the family was so excited. I mean, this was such a big deal. And that we'd go, like, I must have gone about a dozen games that summer, and we would, like, 24,000 fans in that stadium. Like, it was not a lot of fans, but they would go crazy. And Greta and I would go up to the upper deck where all the Latino community would be up there with their whole families because they couldn't afford the really good seats.
Watch the planes take off and almost hit you in the head.
Right, but they were up there. Down below, it's everyone serious about being a fan. Up there, they're singing and dancing and going crazy. Mm-hmm. And, like, when something went well at Shea, even with 14,000 fans, you could hear it.
It was rocking.
Yeah. And just before we get to some of the other stuff, just talk about growing up in New England and having your family a car ride away when you're what? Like, I don't know, you were 25 years old.
I think having my parents there when I went to the Mets was really cool. The best way to describe it is I think that, I don't know how loud I was, but the day I got traded from the Tigers to the Mets, I was in AAA, almost the big leagues, or at least hoping to be in the big leagues. My options ran out with the Tigers to go to. They had to make a decision on me.
You were behind Cecil Fielder.
Yes, behind Cecil Fielder. My options to be kept on a roster, protected without being exposed to other teams, was running out.
Yeah.
So if you're gonna go into that, you might as well trade a player, get something in return. So I wasn't gonna bring back much in return, but when they told me I got traded, I was in the Tigers' spring training offices. It was like the day before the spring training ended.
That became a blessing for you, though.
Oh, man, I shouted. I mean, I was like, oh, you know, I can call my wife, and I can't believe I got traded. You know, the Mets traded for. I mean, I walked out. I realized, like, every person in every office was like, who's that? Yeah, and I think that's the best way to, because I thought, you know, my family would, it was close to home.
But you, for you,
an opportunity.
It was an opening to play.
Yeah, I mean, that was the primary or priority. And my wife and I, Melissa, we were talking all spring training, thinking this may happen, you know, but you don't know. And you just start thinking about teams that may be looking at you, might be a fit for. And the Mets were often on our tongue. You know, we were talking about them as a team. We knew they had just gotten David Segee. He also played some outfield, and they were playing young players. Joe McElvain, we knew the GM had actually tried to trade for me. The only time I knew in my early career that a GM was trying to trade for me when I was in AAA, either the year before or 2 years before. I spent like 3.5 years in AAA, you know, a lot of time in AAA. When he was with the Padres as the GM. And I was told to expect a call during a season when I was playing Toledo. The Padres are going to, you know, trade. I think it was Gary Sheffield, and they want four players in return, and you're one of them. And I was like, you know, at the time I knew that the road to the Tigers was going to be tough.
Yeah,
veterans and stuff like that up there.
You know, you were a later on first pick. You know, John was talking about earlier how is it a hard decision to go to Clemson or not? I mean, you've asked this a lot in your career, but maybe not recently. When you look back at that decision, you know,
mm-hmm.
was that the right decision?
You know, Shaq, it's a great question. I don't think so. I don't regret making the call. I mean, I had a, you know, I didn't know if I'd ever get a day in the major leagues, never mind, you know, 8, 9, 10 years, whatever. So I can't say with any regret that I, or there's no regret in my heart for that. But if I had to do it over again, I would have wanted to play college. I would have wanted to play football. Everyone, oh, baseball's safer, you're not going to get hurt, you know, this and that. But football's different. I mean, I love baseball, but I love football. I mean, I don't know, you know, that's just, and I would have loved to try to play college football. At Clemson, it was a great
school. So were you going to try to be a quarterback too, or just kick? You were going to do both?
I wasn't going to kick. They actually had they had an NFL kicker, and then he turned into an NFL punter. So they didn't need that. They had Rodney Williams, a quarterback, a senior going out. They ran a little kind of option offense, a little Taft-like of old school. Bring back the Loomis prep school, Taft rivalry there.
You had big decisions to make. Talk to us about like what it was like at that time, though. Because now, if you see, you know, an MLB prospect, right, mm-hmm. and you were drafted number 26 overall, first round, mm-hmm. that guy's gonna be everywhere. They're gonna be talking about him. You know, most people didn't know who Rico Bronya was coming out of Watertown, Connecticut.
Right.
How are the scouts finding you, and what is that like as an 18-year-old kid dealing with that?
Yeah, it's a great point. It's completely different today. I mean, there were not many that kind of fell through the cracks back then, but there were a lot more than there are now. I mean, you know, with all the showcases and, you know, social media and everyone's out there, video and everything like that. That was kind of an unknown. I think football got me in the picture, really. It was, okay, I think teams and scouts, they go through periods of what's in, what's hot. Okay, that was a period where multi-sport athlete, football players, the Tigers also drafted Ricardo Ingram. There was Bo Jackson, Dozier. I went into instructional league with Ricardo Ingram. It was like all ACC safety with Georgia Tech.
Yeah.
Baseball second, turned into a Major League Baseball. But so I kind of fit that mold, and I think that at the end of the first round, the Tigers didn't have to spend a lot of money on me. You know, $100,000 in some school.
And nowadays, that'd be for crazy money nowadays.
Well, it'd be like $3-4 million at the end.
Oh, yeah, that's probably the biggest difference is the millions versus the $100,000.
Now, are you at games in high school and playing, and there's scouts there, though? I mean, obviously, they got to come watch.
Yeah, they came. They started, the college recruiting started after my sophomore year for baseball and football mostly. Really my senior year for baseball, the scouts came. They didn't really, maybe over the summer, they might have showed up at some American Legion
games.
Don't
they come to like hoop games and football games too, though, to sort of see a different environment, or is that kind of a myth?
They did. No, they did. They some of the scouts that saw me over the summer, the regional or local scouts, you know, they're not like the whole East Coast, they're more Northeast. If they saw me play over the summer, someone told me they came to watch me play football. I don't know about basketball. I know the college coaches did that like crazy. So, because they're recruiting too, they want you to see them there.
Right.
And so they were in my basketball practices, my junior and senior year, there were coaches in the stands that were falling asleep after about half the practice.
You know, he wants to talk about, he wants to get into U Sports, but I have one more quick question on this, because the money in the first round thing is interesting, because it's more tempting. If you get drafted 26 now, you're a millionaire instantly, right? But then also the organization has that much more invested in you, so they're probably more invested in you making the majors than they were back then. I don't know. Is that true?
Absolutely.
So was it harder to make the bigs back then, or is it the same amount of difficulty for, say, a first-round pick at 26?
Yeah, there's definitely more. The financial, every dollar added on is financial pressure for ownership. Hey, you know, when they make a decision on a GM to keep them or fire them or whatever, they look back at their top draft picks, no question. GM will leave the draft room a lot of times after second or third round and leave it to the rest of the scouts.
That's why he's tacked on.
Yeah, because it's on him who they pick first, second, or third.
And right.
So absolutely with the money nowadays. Back then there was some pressure because it was more how many of your first-round picks make it. Do you get those guys right? So even though the finance was, there was a similar
pressure
for the GMs or scouting directors, but no question it's the, you know, the dial's been turned up with the amount of money now, but they did stick with me. I think the multi-sport athlete, football, basketball, baseball player in high school came into play. They knew it wasn't going to be just add water, press a button, he's a big leaguer. I needed to fail a lot, and I failed a lot. I mean, it was, you know, repeat a year, three instructional leagues, 3.5 years, AAA or whatever I think it was.
It's still quicker than average, you said.
Yeah, you did it like by 4 years it took you about.
My first call-up was fast, yes.
Yeah.
That's true. I actually, You're right. So I was 22. So I was 18. So within my fourth year, I was called up, but I was not ready. I was not ready. I thought it was, but I was way off. Yeah, it wasn't like I could run. I think I could hit. You know, I could survive if they allowed me to survive on a young team. But that was a veteran team with Sparky Anderson, and all the guys were in this and toward the ends of their. You know, they didn't necessarily want this young kid coming
up.
Did
they even talk to you?
Like, not many. I mean, a couple of guys. Like Alan Trammell was awesome. He, you know, he's like, don't tie your shoes that way. You can't have. They had the black spot, you know, with the orange on the road. But you know, you can't wear orange laces with that. I had orange. You take those out. You know, but he was the only guy to do that in the clubhouse with me. Everyone else, either joked, made fun of me, bullied me. But the old school way was, if you weren't being talked to, you should worry.
Yeah.
You know, if they're making fun of you, playing around with you, or. But the guys at my position, like Cecil, didn't really want it. He called me by the wrong name on purpose every day.
Very nice guy.
Yeah, and he was, you know, I'm sure behind the scenes he'd kind of wink at you or whatever, but because he was really cool. But they didn't want you to take their job.
Yeah.
I was a threat to maybe somebody, especially when I went deeper in the first, second game and could pick it a little bit at first, run a little bit.
A little bit quicker than the guy there.
There's a lot of parallels, honestly, with my business. You know, like when there's a bunch of anchors and you get new reporters and anchors, they look at you as a threat. And
competition.
And there are the pros who can handle it and handle it with grace, and there's others that just... And listen, you don't... Ultimately, you don't blame them for wanting to protect what they got, because it's really special to be able to play in the bigs. But the good ones know how to handle it. In a graceful way.
They handle more difficult situations. That's why they probably sustain their value at a high level and keep it.
You want to talk about some useful...
Well, I want to talk about something else, because he was talking about playing for the Tigers and coming up in the Tigers organization. Now, I'm not from Connecticut. I'm originally from Albany, New York. And my first taste of Rico Bronya was playing for the New London, Ontario Tigers. Right, against Albany Colony Yankees.
Yeah.
1990.
Yeah.
And I'm such a baseball nerd,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, he had some prospects on that team.
I am a baseball nerd. The Yankees did.
We had a couple, but they were loaded.
So listen, I'm such a baseball nerd that I actually have a box score from a game where you didn't bat against Kamenicki because he played the first game. But in the second game, you look down the bottom here, you went 2-for-4 with 2 home runs.
Oh, it was a Militello? I can't remember. Sam Militello?
Probably, maybe. Let's see. My eyes are just as bad, too.
No,
you know what it was? It was Royal R.C. Clayton.
Royce Clayton. Royal Clayton, his brother.
Royal's brother.
Yeah, absolutely.
He was Royal, and his voice was Royce.
Yep. Did Royal ever make it?
He got a cup of coffee, I think.
Yeah, he might have got a call, but it's AAA, I know that.
By the way, Tigers are only $30.
That's a good deal. Fireside. They had all those lawsuits back in the early 2000s.
Oh, look at this box score. I love it.
J.T. Snow and Bernie Williams.
Bernie Williams was playing center field.
Yep.
I don't know if J.T. Snow. Greg Sparks and Don Sparks, not brothers.
Right. Kelly.
Billy Massey, who actually
did the Connecticut Capitals for a while.
Yeah. And that's crazy. I even have tickets.
Awesome. Wow.
From the game.
From the Albany Colony. That was the coldest place in April.
Awful.
I mean, the clubhouse wasn't a clubhouse. It was a locker room beyond left field.
You had to walk out there.
You had to walk out there. So it wasn't like you could go in between innings into the locker room and
The visiting team had to walk the walk of shame out. Yeah. Now the home team wasn't much better, because they had to walk through the fans, underneath the bleachers, and into like basically behind the concession stand.
Yeah, the big bleacher side.
When I was a kid, I used to go and I would watch like you're a prospect, so I'm surprised. I feel like I have a ball signed by you somewhere. I feel like it, but I can't dig it out of
this. We played them a lot.
This was short notice here.
That's
but
awesome.
So
that
I used to
really,
go.
That's really cool.
I used to go and you know like. The big prospects that came through playing against the Yankees, because my dad and I had season tickets, I would go out there and I would wait while they walked out. And if a guy broke a bat or something, I would ask him for the bat. And I was like a 13-year-old kid, and 99.9% of the time, they would give me the bat.
Oh, I'm sure, yeah.
And it'd be broken. I'd take it back home. My grandfather would put them back together to make them look real.
Nice.
And I'd get them. They'd come back in the town, and I'd get them to sign the bat. And so many of the players would be like, look at the bat. And they'd be like, you gave me it. And they're like, that's the same bat.
Is that where you met Bobby Dickerson?
That's where I met Bobby. Yeah.
So he has a lifelong friendship with Bobby Dickerson.
Oh, really?
Because he met him when he was a teenager.
Yep. He played the Albany Yankees.
And it's fascinating because they became friendly. And he was being nice to a dad and his kid
during a rain delay.
Yeah. And Bobby went to your wedding.
Yeah, I was at his wedding. With Gerald.
To have that kind of relationship.
Yeah, so I've been friends with him for ages. It's interesting how the connections you make over the years. But it was so funny, like. I coming to Connecticut, I knew of you, mm-hmm. but then, you know, Chris mentioned you, and then I think my wife was at the same game, and, you know, it just kind of clicked, and I was like, I remember watching you play for the New London Ontario Tigers.
It makes me think now they're talking really pretty firm, I think, about contracting the minor leagues.
Yeah, it's pretty sad.
So, and I think, you know, a team like,
would not be there. No,
it wouldn't. And then your experience
would be gone.
With the players walking to the clubhouse, the bats meeting.
And that's what you still get that at the lower levels of the minor leagues. Now, granted, you go to the Yard Goats, and it's more of a major league experience.
Right.
But there's a lot of clubs around the United States where you're still going to get that kind of
hometown feel. Yeah,
I think you know, I've given this a lot of thought because ultimately it stinks because the experience and athletes are different now. Like, you know, if Bernie Williams is playing low A or whatever, like, people really know who he is, and he's probably hard to access even if he was coming through now.
Right.
So I think a part of that era sort of has passed by a little bit, because even the guys in the Cape, they're kind of hard to access now. The college kids are on the Cape. But I would say is that I understand why Major League Baseball is doing it, because they don't, with the technology and scouting, they don't need a couple hundred people in their system to know who's going to make it. Yeah. But for the country, it stinks.
It does small town America.
Just because it's like so great, and it gives people a chance to play. And sure,
it's affordable.
Baseball can totally get away with a small minor league system because they don't need it, right? They don't need it. But
they'll win either way, I think. I mean, or maybe they want, you know, financially they want more, you know, control over things. You can centralize it a little bit. You don't give up like part ownership to the team or GM to other people that are not with your organization. Every 2 years of changing
they
affiliates,
they want to control it.
Yeah, so you lose control. But I mean, that was, in my opinion, the awesomeness of the brand, all the different branches that made America love baseball, or I think we still do. But
I just saw it in Joe Mauer when he was 18. I think you probably shot that story. And the kid was just like, Mauer's just like you. He was a three-sport superstar.
He was a quarterback,
and he was Mr. Minnesota, in basketball. And, like, he's sitting there in New Britain, Connecticut, you know?
Wondering, what am I doing here?
What am I doing here? But, like, you could talk to him any day you wanted to, you know? And he ended up, you know, obviously health was an issue for him, but he was a Hall of Fame caliber athlete,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely,
And that, with New Britain, the way Minnesota was, you had all those stories.
A huge pipeline.
Coming through.
Ortiz.
Yeah, they kept their players.
Yeah.
You know, real quick, you know, we're talking with Rico Bronya here, John Senecal, and Brian Shackman with Fan Base, a deep dive into the greatest rivalry in sports. Wanted to quickly touch on some U Sports things and then get to the Red Sox stuff, because the story with the Red Sox and you is fascinating. You growing up a fan and getting not maybe all the moments you wanted, but one moment that will last a lifetime. But, you know, you have a son who's an athlete.
Yeah.
And you sort of brought it up, like, you know, in terms of you have a son who plays competitive baseball.
Yep. Two boys.
And you got a lot of ideas on
And I've coached a lot of Little League baseball, and I'm curious to see what your opinion is as far as, you know, the interest in baseball with youth. I tend to think they're losing interest because it's a thinking game. It's a long duration game.
Right.
And the kids nowadays are very all over the place, and they tend to move towards soccer more, where they're constantly moving, or basketball, or even a tennis or something like that, where baseball is more of just like you got to be 120% in.
Mm-hmm.
What's your take?
Everything you said, I totally think is, you know, I've said it many times now watching Hunter play baseball. He used to play lacrosse, but since he's played baseball, you can see the kids that really want to think in between pitches. You know, it's still the same though. You want a pitcher to work fast and you want the pace to move, but you really just want it steady. So whatever it is, you just kind of want a steady pace so you can get a feel for the pace of the game. But that's the beauty, is the pace is never the same.
Right.
So then another pitcher comes in, it changes. Or you know, when you have a clock, like in most sports, the pace is kind of dictated by the clock. You have a no-huddle offense, you got a four-minute offense, you got a shotguns, whatever, play clock 5, 4, 3. Baseball is the game, and that's kind of what my dad always told me. It's so cool. You know, there's really no end. There's no zeros at the end, on the scoreboard at the end of the game for the time.
Right.
You just play until the team, you know, with the last at-bat.
Straight grab hits at a money ball. No clock on this.
There's no clock. Know? Yeah, but it's like that clock, the uniqueness of that clock, that it changes many times within a game, within one game.
Oh, yeah.
And then the next day, it's completely different. And the next day, so 160, you know, every year, it's got this different pace to it. But an MLB player or players, the pace will be consistent. So whatever it is, the players learn to adjust pretty quickly because it's going to stay the same.
Right.
The consistency level is so high. Minor league, not a little better, or not as good, but, you know, as you work down to college and high school, it just gets
slower,
worse and slower, yeah. or not as structured.
Right.
So it's fast for these two hitters, slow for that. There's no feel for a pace.
But for instance, like my son, who knows if he'll even play high school baseball, mm-hmm. but he had, with COVID, I had to get him doing something. And the only something we could get him into was AAU baseball. So I got, and they need the money, so they took my kid. My kid was probably bottom four or five kids in the team, although I think he could have played a little bit more than they played him. But what I want to say was is that he started, and he's doing fall ball because he transitioned
nice.
From 12 to 13, so he's got to get used to the longer throws.
Yep.
And so it's just fall ball.
He's 13. Or
he's 12. He's 12. And he's going to be 13 in November. He's undersized. But he's playing flag football just because his little brother was, he wanted to do it. And I took him, he went to flag football last night, he was late to hitting, and I told him, I'm not perfect, but I tell my kids not to lie, you know what I mean? But this time I said, blame it on me. Tell him I was late getting out of work, because they will bench him.
They'll take it out on him.
If he was not there, because
yeah.
they want you 100% committed.
Yeah.
So if he was late because he was...
And he's 12.
If he was late because he was late, benched. If he was
right.
late because he was at flag football, benched. So the only chance of him not get penalized is if it was my fault.
If dad's out from
right.
work.
And so I don't advocate being a little, but then in that case, I wanted to protect him. So my point is that
right.
you are a three-sport athlete. This 12-year-old who's a fringe kid is getting that kind of pressure. Like, do you think you would have quit something?
Man, yeah, that was, it's different now than it was then.
Is it though? Was there pressure on you?
It was just Little League.
I played
then, though,
how
right?
many different teams I played on in the summer. I played Pearl Street basketball, football camps, a baseball camp, TwineMap baseball, American Legion baseball, got ready for football, you know, coming up with the lifting and, you know, throwing and stuff for the football season. That was a day. I mean, you know, it was like, okay, I got basketball 3 times this week, baseball 5, you know, it's like you just juggled. But I think I tried to prioritize, obviously, if my dad was coaching the Legion team, which he did, you know, we had a really good team, and it was like, okay, this is what we're doing, no vacations, you know,
right.
we're going to play 55 games more than everyone else, but you got to be in. So I was in with that, but I definitely got to Pearl Street games at 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock on those nights when we finished by 7, it gets dark. And
you loved it.
Loved it. I mean, you gotta. I couldn't get. Then I'd go outside at home and hit and throw balls against the wall, or a friend down the street, and we play, you know, home run derby, wiffle ball in the backyard. There was no. It did never got old. I think structure is. You know, it's great when you get a little older. I think kids, if you're in it for the kids, this is the way I think about it. If you're in it for them, when they're 10, 11, 12, 13, you know, they don't know yet.
Right.
They're just having fun. They don't play as much backyard baseball or whatever, right?
Can't stand it.
Yeah, so now the only time they get to do that is when it's in a structured environment.
Right.
But it still should be less structured. I would have so much not a problem with kids. That tells me like a coach is interested in their record or how they're doing. And
right.
He wants to teach commitment. There's nothing wrong with that. At that age, that's a parental thing, maybe in the kind of the bigger picture, broader picture here. But... let the kids do what. Hey, you know, you're a little late because you were doing flag football. I hope you had a great time. You
yeah.
know, just jump in, but maybe wait till everyone's done
right.
and you're last. But
right.
you're still gonna get the hit.
Right.
I mean, it just that's
yeah, it's a little extreme.
Yeah.
I just you know, and these are all tropes and conversations that
yeah.
are had all over the place. I mean, the specialization is a problem, but it's everywhere, and the parents want a return on their investment, and the kids are,
mm-hmm.
I just, you know, I think that I want my kids to play, whatever's in season is a priority, but it bugs me. Your guys, his two sons are really good about just going in the backyard and playing. They are. My guys,
mm-hmm.
the only thing they'll do now, they're into the Celtics, they'll go in my little crappy courtyard and shoot some baskets, but like, I was like, why don't you guys go out and play wiffle ball?
Yeah.
Like, no, like it's just. I was like,
just go make stuff up.
It's just crazy how that's changed in childhood.
When you were younger playing, like in Little League and stuff,
mm-hmm.
you're left-handed.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're probably one of the best players on the team, obviously. Now were you the guy that had to get stuck catching as a lefty or playing shortstop as a lefty?
Yep, I caught all the way up into Legion.
Yeah, see, that's what I'm saying.
Well, the catcher quit. I was gonna play another position first. But the catcher quit, my dad went, you're catching.
But at some point, you're sitting there thinking like, all right, I don't think I'm going to make it as
yeah.
a left-handed catcher in the major league.
Didn't even think about that.
No.
No, we had a game tonight to win. I was just trying to beat the next team we're playing.
And you're older at this point. You're 17, yeah, that's 17 18 years
yeah,
old.
Yeah, that's you know, yeah, that's almost the middle of high school.
Right. That's a great point. So when did you decide you said I'm going to be a first baseman?
I really didn't even, you know, it was really more, am I going to pitch or play a position? I just played first a lot because of the left-handed thing. And I didn't play a lot of outfield. And I think, you know, he's okay over there, so we'll keep him there. But at the time, it was maybe pitch or play a position and hit. That was the only, what you know, thing that was out there. But I didn't even think about that stuff. Like,
see, I always feel bad, like, when I'm coaching a little league team and one of the best players is a lefty. And, like oh, we have, like, a lefty catcher's glove.
Yeah, yeah, I know. And in the Oakland A's, we have them, too.
I'm but like, it hurts their future. Is that your
point? Right, and the kid's 12, and I feel bad.
And then why don't lefties catch? I don't know. Into the thing where, okay, I'm, like, traditional, but Why not? I mean, we're questioning everything nowadays.
So I always thought it was the concern over the hitting all the right-handed hitters in the head or
when
something.
When they throw,
why? You know, there's a lot of left-handed hitters that are right-handed catchers. If there's one technique to do it that way, why isn't there the same?
And by shortstop, it's about a body turn, right? Isn't it about a body turn?
I would say that if you're a good enough athlete, you could probably play any position.
It's amazing, right? I mean, but still, you don't see left. There's not a left-handed shortstop.
None.
No, there would be. Don Mattingly played some third, and that would be the spot to play. There's a lot of maybe second, but there's a lot of plays in the middle of the infield where it would take you a little more time.
And you don't have that time.
And you don't have that time up there, right? At third base, you can kind of play an angle. It's more like quick. The ball's on top of you. You can charge bump play a little differently to get there.
But in the grand scheme of things,
I mean, double play maybe. But
when you're at the point where you got a good idea that you got talent, you're going somewhere. Mm-hmm. You're not going to be a left-handed catcher in the major leagues. So you're either going to be a first baseman, mm-hmm. a pitcher. Now you got to choose either or.
Yeah, they chose that for me.
Okay.
I was not a good enough pitcher. That arm, my arm was, you know, high school was fine, maybe college or something.
You know, it's interesting, before we get into the Red Sox Yankee stuff, I listened to the Jay Payton thing you did with the Mets, with, I think it was Howie Roseman.
Yeah, And
I think about sabermetrics, and you're into the statistics stuff now. Mm-hmm. I don't know how the sabermetrics and the statistical analysis would have affected how they would have approached your hitting or attacking you. But he was a very good defensive first baseman, probably top three fielding percentage for first baseman,
and almost first glove, almost a gold glover.
Yeah, one year you should. I mean, there's a couple of years,
like three errors or something.
You should have had it. It was like 9-9, whatever. It was like unbelievable. But you talked about that in that conversation that I didn't think about it because everyone thinks from first base, whatever, right? Mm-hmm. But when you can play a solid first base or have good range, it gives every position over the ability to be more aggressive. Right?
No question.
And so I hadn't really thought about it in those terms, and I wonder if the database stuff of now would probably have given you more credibility as a first baseman, because I think that they can calculate how many outs and runs you save.
Yeah, defensive run. The metrics are improving for defense. It's still going to be probably the last to be as accurate or the least accurate of all the. There's a lot of factors with defense that come into play that it's hard to really calculate perfectly. You know, as you can do with maybe some hitting and pitching stuff, or be closer to home with those. No question, it's a teammate. This is why I think it's kind of difficult to measure. It's more of a team-oriented position. You can do things for other players that don't necessarily get measured or valued as much, except by your teammates.
Like a scoop or something like that.
Or really the main thing is that
they have guys head on first base.
Yeah, they have the confidence to make every throw. So they can make plays, which is what you're talking about, Brian. So they're going to try to make plays, and they're going to be
not going to hold back.
So all their ability can come out,
right?
And that doesn't always happen. They conserve something, you know. If they're not confident in the first baseman, more than just something, a lot more. But if they can let it all go, okay. So let's let them be their best them. And then also you can, if you have range, like JT Snow was unbelievable, his range, and he won it a year I didn't, but he should have won it. Maybe a couple years with the Giants, because he was a cat. So he was this unbelievable Don Mattingly like, or Keith Hernandez like first baseman. Everyone on the infield can just shift over. Yeah. So when I've scouted a lot of play, you know, in the pros and the minor leagues and MLB, the biggest mistake I see at first base, and I definitely see it in the amateur levels, is they just don't know where to line up. Their positioning is so off, and they just don't A, get coached on it probably, and B, they just want to get to first base. So if a throw's coming to them, they can just put their foot on the bag, turn around and catch a throw. So what we learned to do was run all the way from the outfield grass almost, while this guy with a great arm is about ready to throw it, you're halfway there.
You got to be there.
Yeah, and you're going to be there, and you're going to make a play if it's a bad throw. Right. So that
So the player will make the throw essentially before you're in there.
Yeah, it's like a quarterback throwing an out route. Yeah, he's doing it before the break. But it's not before the break because it's what you do.
Right.
Nowadays, you watch the clunk clunk, you know, he's 12 by 12 off the base. You know, he's cookie cutter. Play here.
Right.
And then a ground ball goes through the four hole and he takes two steps, but maybe I should get first. My first day with a new team, or even my same team every year with the new pitchers, during PFP, pitcher fielding practice, PFP, would be, I'm going after everything cover first. That was my only instructions to the new pitchers. Like, if they didn't know me, or I didn't know them, I would just tell them, I'm going after everything, so cover.
Hmm.
So, and when there's doubt,
they know you're going to be going for it.
Yeah, so when there's no doubt, there's no mistakes. So I told them, I'm going to dive, I'm going to try to make
whatever
plays,
I gotta do.
Push the second baseman up the middle.
So their default response is to go first.
Go first.
Right.
Be there. If we don't, you know, I'm not going to try to get that ball and then recover.
Right.
So, I mean, this is great, you know, positions. I love it. That's the minutia of that.
That concludes this episode and part one of our conversation with former major leaguer Rico Bronya. Tune in to the next episode when we talk to Rico about his huge home run as a member of the Boston Red Sox. You've been listening to Fanbase, a deep dive into the greatest rivalry in sports. Check us out on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.